Well, we're just coming up on 7:30 right now, so I'd like to welcome all members and guests. As per usual, I'll reiterate that we're happy to have guests with us at any time at the RLPCS Group if you want to join. This month is a good time to join because for your $20, you'll get 2 years for the price of one. So we go to our website and go to the click the link at the top for join or renew. And that'll take you through where you can part with your money. So I hope that everybody here, I'll just remember now, I'm going to mute all. And in this case here, because it's our regular monthly meeting, we do not allow people to unmute themselves during the presentation. After the main presentation, you'll have the ability to unmute yourself, or you can use the chat to put in any comments or questions. And Bob Harris has kindly agreed to monitor the chat window, and he will interrupt Linda if he thinks there's something that is really important to be covered off right away. Otherwise, comments and questions will be relayed after the main presentation. So I don't know if everybody here found out about it in advance. We just found out today that Alan had some difficulties with his voice today. And so his presentation is going to be postponed until the fall. And thankfully, Linda agreed to step in and give a presentation on tips and techniques in photography. And so we're very fortunate to have her giving the presentation tonight. And I think with that, I will now turn it over to Linda. And Linda, take it away. Oh, I should introduce Linda in case anybody doesn't know her. Linda has been a member of the RLPCS Group for quite a few years now. She is also on the executive of the Orleans Photo Club as competition director. And so she's had many, many years of experience in photography, as well as giving presentations on various aspects of photography, both through the Ottawa Public Library here at the OPCUG and at the Orleans Photo Club, as well as other venues. So with that, and my thanks, and the thanks of the group, I would like to turn it over to Linda to lead us through tonight's presentation.
Okay, so I'm just shared my screen there. I hope that looks yep. Right. Okay. So just before I start, I'll just mention that some of this will seem a little familiar to you if you do read the monthly columns that I write on digital photography. And I have done presentations before, so some of it may seem familiar, but hopefully it's always good to have a reminder if you are fairly advanced in photography. I still pick up tips from all sorts of photographers that come into our club, so it's great to learn from each other. So by all means, put comments or anything in the chat, and we'll discuss them at the end. So just to kick it off by saying that, first of all, thanks for letting me step in and foist my presentation on you. Alan would be a lot more entertaining, but hopefully we'll get to hear his website presentation some other time. So it doesn't really matter what type of camera you're shooting with. I will let you know there's a few slides where most cell phones would not cope with the situation or make adjustments, and I'll let you know when we hit those. So we're going to ramble through a bunch of different topics tonight. I'm going to start off just with basic camera structure. We're going to talk about composition, how to get off the auto setting to adjust your depth of field, how to use light to the best advantage, because it's photography, it's all about light. And then talking specifically about taking better pictures of people, animals, flowers, shooting near water, and then a sunrise, sunset. So just some tips for those type of topics. And I find those topics come up often when you're traveling, so they're good to have in your back pocket. So what is a camera and how does it work? Basically, it's a box with a hole and the light goes into the hole. That goes through a lens. And then there's an aperture, and that determines how much light is going to come in based on the size of that opening, which the camera, you either adjust manually, or the camera adjusts automatically for you. Then there's some sort of ability to record that light. And on modern cameras, it's a sensor. It used to be film, but for the most part now it's sensors. And then there's a shutter mechanism so that this light that's pouring isn't going to pour in forever. So it's going to pour in for a very small period of time, like a fraction of a second typically. And so that shutter mechanism, think of it sort of like a Venetian blind, and it's open and then it's closed very quickly. And then you'll have electronic viewfinders so you can sort of see what you're shooting. And then it's going to get whatever's on the sensor will get written to the SD card. And you hook that up to your computer and you offload your images. So this is kind of a standard type camera. So this is a look at a DSLR. And you can see there the light comes in and it hits this mirror. And the sole purpose of this mirror is to reflect up into this pentaprism so that you can see from the optical viewfinder what you're taking a picture of. Okay, so when you take a picture and you hit that shutter mechanism, you'll hear the mirror flip up. It's got to get out of the way so the light can come in and hit the sensor at the back here. Okay, so the mirror flips out of the way and that's what makes that clunk. And so that's what people like about mirrorless cameras is you don't get that clunk because there is no need for a mirror. It's all done electronically with the viewfinder, etc. Great. So we're going to start off easy. We're going to start off with some tips for composition. We're going to talk about the rule of thirds, but think of these things as guidelines rather than rules. There's also the rule of odds. I like to have people keep horizon straight because I think that's the first thing that screams amateur if you don't even have your horizon straight. So be cognizant of that. And a lot of cameras have a display feature while you're shooting that allows you to see that horizon. I use mine all the time because if I try to get the horizon straight, I still don't get it straight. There's something wrong with my eyeballs. It just doesn't work. So I use that line often or I straighten it in editing when I get home. When you're shooting up to something vertical, like a building, you'll notice that oftentimes, because you're not the same height as the building, there's going to have parallax of lines coming in, bending in from the side. So sure, accept that, but try and keep the a vertical line in the middle straight. Leave space for moving objects in front. Put denser objects below, lighter ones on top. And look for angles, line, leading lines, triangles, things like that. Anything that isn't static, and I'll show you examples of that so you get the idea. So, dividing your image into thirds. So, what we think of the thirds as foreground, middle ground, and background. And this is particularly important if you only shoot with a cell phone that doesn't have an optical zoom. So most cell phones are that way right now. That might change, but for the most part, most people's cell phones don't have an optical zoom. And that's important because you don't want all your pictures in your cell phone to look like, oh man, she was so far away. It's too bad because she's too bad she didn't have a zoom. So you just fill it in. So you've got foreground here with the trees, and then you've got some middle ground with the red rocks, and then your background with the hill and the sky. So that's your foreground, middle ground, and background. And then what you do is you drop down two lines to form this grid. And this grid will probably appear, it may appear when you're taking the picture. Certainly if you're using the back screen, it'll probably appear. It certainly always appears in editing programs when you go to crop because they know people want to use this rule of thirds. So if you have object of interest, then it's recommended that you put it at one of these intersection points, not dead center. So it doesn't apply to every image, but it's if you have an object of interest, think about that. So here's a picture of tulips clearly, but I did want to include the art gallery, but I made sure I didn't put it in the center. And you can see it doesn't have to be exactly at the intersection point, but just that idea of not being too centered. Here's a nice example of foreground with the trees, middle ground with the boat, and then the background with the autumn hills there. This was in Mont Tremblant. And then the boat goes at an intersection point. Now here's a good example of, okay, I put the ship at the intersection point, but I've also given the ship lots of room to move. So don't have a moving object right to the right-hand side of your frame because it just does, it just seems like it's going to hit that frame. Give it lots of room to breathe. So the hand's in the middle, but the chickadee is the most important part, and that's in your intersection. Now, with something like this where it fills the frame, you don't have to worry about having it off-center. You could. I've seen photographers take a single blossom and put it off-center, but certainly there's nothing wrong with centering something when it's filling the frame. So here you can see, if I had this photo and it was just these sort of straight line of the horizon, straight line of the dock, it's very, very static. So it was nice that I was able to get a bit of a diagonal line with this part of the pier and then a triangle up at the top. So just look for things like that where you can build a little bit of, it's almost like movement into it. Now, this is an example of putting heavier objects below than above. Now, in this case, they are literally heavy, big, heavy rocks, but it's that idea of sort of the mass of a element in your photo best to be a little lower down. This is an example of using your foreground to create a three-dimensional effect so that it looks like you can kind of walk into the photo. Another one, just using foreground to build a bit of context. Now here's one that I took in Iceland, and we were hiking up from the river there. I needed a break, and so I wanted to take a picture, but Iceland can be pretty barren. So I took this picture, but I didn't like it. So I stood back a little bit further, very, very, just a few feet back. You can see I'm not far back. I got some rocks in. I got some flowers in, little alpine flowers, and it's a nicer photo. So there's a lot of times you're taking photos kind of just to record the event type thing, reference photos, like I was in Iceland, this was the river I saw. But I always try and make even the reference shots to be pretty. So that's what I try and do. Now the rule of odds states that it's easier to have a pleasant composition with three things than four things. And I typically find this to be true. Once you get to high numbers, like say over seven or something, you really probably can't tell if it's even or odd. But certainly the three, four, I like five better than six. And so you can see it's a nice grouping of the ladies there. But in weddings, of course, you know, if you have a bride and a groom, that's two. You're not going to throw in the mother-in-law just to get three. So you just have to use your own, you have to use your own head on that one. But it is easier. I recently did some four sailboats, and it took me forever to get a good composition. I finally did, but man, it's so much easier when it's an odd number. Okay, the next thing I want to mention is context. So often, especially when you're traveling, it's nice to have context to let people know the size of things. So these are falls on the Cornell campus in Ithaca. And you kind of think you have an idea of how big these waterfalls are, but I actually photoshopped out a fisherman that was at the bottom. So I'm going to put him back in. And you can sort of see, you're probably surprised just how big those waterfalls are because, you know, all of a sudden the trees are bigger than we thought. So it's always nice to have a reference point of a human or a car or a dog or something. But cars are kind of, I don't find them that attractive in a photo with a waterfall. So humans are always nice. We do know the size of a human. And then just being able to lead a viewer through your photo is nice. It makes it feel more three-dimensional. Or here, like I've got this little S-shaped line of stones leading towards Chris. And you don't have to have the person you're traveling with always facing the camera and smiling. Like, of course he's happy. He's traveling with me. Why wouldn't he be happy? We're on vacation, you know. So I don't need him to turn around and smile every time or, you know, raise his hand or whatever. So he often doesn't know when I'm taking his picture and vice versa. Okay, just a little bit about framing. So this is a crappy photo. Took this many, many, many years ago. I was on a ship, but you can't tell where I am. You have no idea where I am. Too much boring sky, too much boring water. No room for the ship to move. So This is a better type of image. So here you can see exactly my environment. I'm using the deck as a frame, and I've got the sun coming in. You can see exactly how far I am from these ships, so you know I'm not zoomed, and it just gives you the whole story. Same with this, just using the portholes for a frame. Portugal, very kind of traditional shot from, I did take a while to find this cave, but I eventually walked down the beach far enough to find a cave. And then using foreground, it can be at the top, it doesn't have to be at the bottom. It just has to be whatever's closest to you in the camera. Okay, this is what I call working the scene. So this is especially important when you're going to a very famous area and you're trying to get something that looks just a little different from every other single photo you've seen from that area. So here's an easily recognizable spot in Canada, Peggy's Cove. I took that in 2017, but that's the reference shot. But the one I want is something that not everybody else has. So I took this one. And that became my favorite picture of Peggy's Cove, just because it was a little different. Now time passes, fast forward to 2022. I quite like this shot. I found it pretty. It's not on my wall or anything, but I liked it. I liked the curve of the stones and the wildflowers and that. So I looked around to get another different type of shot because the anchor was long gone. They'd redone the whole environment of Peggy's Cove there, make it more accessible. So I looked around and I found these armchairs instead, which were kind of cute because it looked like you could put your feet out and rest them on the top of the lighthouse. And then I wanted to get the beautiful curved architecture of this accessible path leading towards the lighthouse. Okay, let's get a little bit technical. So getting off auto, if you just always shoot in the auto setting, there's nothing wrong with that, but you are giving up a huge opportunity to control what your photos look like. You might be happy with them, or you might think, that's not quite what I wanted, but I don't know how to get what I wanted. So a lot of cameras have this kind of dial, so this is not cell phones, obviously. There are some settings for the more recent types of cell phones, but they're also different. I'm not going to try and get into those, but this is very standard for any type of, even a point shoot, a bridge camera, a DSLR, a mirrorless, whatever. So if you've left it on auto, that's great, but if you want to take it off auto, you can try these scene modes. So this is a little guy running. So typically what your camera's going to do is try and give you a faster shutter speed because you've told it you're going to take an action shot. So you might want to sort of freeze that and not have a total blur on your image. The portrait one, typically they're going to apply a short depth of field so you get a little bit of softening in the background, but they may also do a little less sharpening in the processing so, you know, lines won't be quite so harsh on your face or whatever. So, but it does depend on the camera. This guy with the moon coming beside his head, that's a night shot. Might give you a wider aperture to let a little more light in, higher ISO so you have a bit faster speed, but it may also underexpose the image, which is great because that gives you a faster speed. And then you're basically telling your camera, it's okay, I don't mind if this image is dark, because otherwise your camera is going to default to it being, oh, this must be a day scene. So you got to tell it, no, I'm okay if it looks a little dark, it's at night. And then the landscape one typically will give you a long depth of field, and they might bump up the blues and greens. And then the super macro that's available on a lot of cameras, that's self-explanatory, just lets you get a little closer to a flower or whatever. Okay, if you take it off the scene settings and off auto, then you have options M for manual, and that's where you get to set the aperture and the shutter speed. So you're deciding how much light is coming into the camera and how long it's going to be coming through. If you're in the S or T, it might be BART TV on yours, that's when you set the shutter speed and your camera will automatically set an appropriate aperture and adjust the ISO accordingly. If you're set for A or AV, you set the aperture and your camera will adjust the shutter speed accordingly. And again, all this is assuming you're on auto ISO. And then P is where is a good place to start, because P sort of stands for programmable. It means that the camera is going to basically decide what your aperture and shutter speed are, but you can make minor adjustments to the light using those little plus minus dials or buttons that you probably have at the back of your camera. And that's where I started years and years ago. When I got off auto, I went to P. And so it gave me that ability to lighten my image or darken my image and override my camera's decision. Now, I didn't take too long to realize I wanted more than that. Now I basically, for most images, I live on aperture priority. Okay, so let's say we're going to do aperture priority. Let me just give you a few examples of how you can use that. So aperture is the opening, as I mentioned. When it's wide open, it's a low number, 1.8, say f1.8. If it's a high number, it's a very tiny opening. So if you're trying to get an image that is in focus from the front all the way to infinity, you need a fairly large number, and that means it's a small opening, and you'll get that long depth of field. Now, this has nothing to do with zooming, because you'd have to incorporate the focal length and all those things in your calculation, and you can, you know, get a table of that and keep it in your camera bag. But this is if you weren't zoomed and you were just fairly close to that lobster trap, you'd have to go f11 or higher probably. Okay, now here's one where I wanted the flower in sharp focus, and I wanted a soft background focus, so I had it at f5.6. But I wasn't too happy because it was kind of a gray blob. So I just made the aperture a little tinier, and that kept this in sharp focus. But then you could easily see that it was a park bench in the back, so it didn't just look like a gray blob. So that's how you can just play around until you get something that you like. That's saying that's what you decided is important or less important. Well, here's a cute little tip. So here were these flowers, and it kind of had an ugly fence, this ugly wire fence in the background. And by doing a very wide aperture, you can basically blur them out, and they just look like little dewdrops. You can also do that if something is coming across the image, like a very small, I don't even want to say a branch, but a piece of grass or something. And if you have a short enough depth of field, that just becomes so out of focus, it basically disappears. Now, this is using the portrait mode of my cell phone. So a lot of phones have the portrait mode. I do encourage you to use it if you're taking pictures. I walk around the neighborhood all the time, and I always have my cell phone with me. I don't bring my camera. I'm just going out for a 20-minute walk. But there's lots of flowers that are really close to the road. I don't have to walk onto anyone's property. So I just keep my cell phone handy and put it in portrait mode. Now, if you have a camera with a zoom, and for whatever reason, if you've tried, I mean, my bridge is like this. When I set it to as low, it doesn't have a big range of f-stops, but if I set it to the widest aperture, I still don't get a soft background like this. So what I do is I stand back and I zoom with that camera, and with the short depth of field setting, like the wide aperture, I will then get a soft background. So you just have to play around. So even with like say you had a 28 to 200 zoom or something, stand back and zoom in. It's probably going to give you a better background. Okay, so what's the best thing about cell phone cameras? Well, typically we have them with us, so this is what makes them great. And they are getting to be better and better quality. But here are the things that I like to take pictures of with my cell phone. So indoor shots, any situations with low light are really good with cell phones. Close subjects, that's fine. As I say, if I'm just out walking. Night shots for sure, because again, low light. But as I say, I encourage you to add in foreground to make it a nice picture. And of course, selfies, I don't take many of those. But they're obviously available. The downsides of a cell phone is you have fewer megapixels typically than a camera, usually no optical zoom. So if you're doing that spread thing, you're not zooming, you're cropping. So unless you have multiple lenses on the back when you turn your camera around, You do not have an optical zoom and you're just losing resolution. If you do that, take a picture and put it on your computer and go to crop it, you're going to have a very pixelated looking photo. So you have to be very careful. Although, as I say, things are improving. There's more and more megapixels in the camera photo, in the phone cameras now. I find that the biggest drawback to cell phone pictures is the cell phone makes too many decisions about sharpening, saturation, vibrancy, things like that, that I find hard to undo in my photo editing. I don't want it to look that saturated or that sharpened, you know, especially if I'm taking nature. I want it to look natural. So the one I have right now, the Google Pixel 6 Pro, is pretty good. It doesn't oversaturate or overprocess things, but I still have a little bit of trouble undoing it. But I can shoot both RAW and JPEG with that one, so it gives me a little bit more options. And you do have limited control over your aperture, your speed, etc. Again, this is changing with the newer phones, but most people are not able to control. There's light settings, but controlling depth of field is tricky. So as I say, zoom sparingly. So here's another example of a cell phone image. I couldn't zoom to the mountains, so I just built in. And I mean, I was just walking around the deck. I didn't have my big camera with me. Took this inside the parliamentary library. I also had my other camera, but I wasn't allowed a tripod. And when I compared the pictures, the cell phone did a better job because of the low light. Inside restaurants, that kind of thing is great. When you don't have your camera, nighttime. And here I did my tripod, and I did take quite a few photos, but in the end, the one that the cell phone took, I liked the best. Here was another one. I had the tripod, and this horse was moving. I was in a ditch, and there was a lot of vegetation. I couldn't move the tripod and get it set back up fast enough. So I thought, forget about it. So I just grabbed my phone and followed the horse, got it to the composition I wanted, and took the shot. So another thing you can do with cell phones, because you can't zoom. So say the thing that really interested you in this photo was the ship. Say that was a very important ship for you. What you can do to get people to find that in your image is put somebody looking at it and shoot them from the back. So the first thing people look at is people. So we can't see his face, but we'll think, well, what's he looking at? And then your eye goes to the very back of the photo. So that's handy if you're in a setting. I mean, it might not be a ship. It might be a pagoda in the mist or whatever. It's a handy trick to have, especially if you have just a cell phone. And, of course, taking pictures of food, always fun. But take it before you start eating so it looks nice and neat. Okay, capturing motion. You can go for very dramatic. You can crop later, make it even more dramatic, more impact. We don't need a lot of extra stuff around to get the idea. Or it could be a motion that's very gentle. Now here's one where I was talking about everything being horizontal. So no diagonal lines here. We've got a vertical mast. We've got a horizontal horizon. The ship's deck, the guy wire on if you don't know, I'm on a boat, but it's hard to tell, but that's the guy wire of my boat. And it looks very static. So 2 seconds later, I took this shot, and yeah, now it looks like everybody's moving, okay? So it's just building in some foreground, building in something that gives you an angle and not quite so static. We were doing the exact same speed as in the other photo, but this is much more effective. You might be just showing tension, just like these little seeds, just about falling off. Or a very gentle motion, sort of wisping away. Or where you can get that blur of a moving vehicle. So think about that. So using light to your advantage, I always use this example. You've probably seen it before. So ugly light, ugly background, and I realized I was shooting into the light, which does not make your job easy. So walk by it, turn around, shot the other way, and a hugely different photo just because the light is now in my favor. So following the light is the best thing you can do. And that's always what I'm looking for, is like a golden hour in the evening. So this is mid-morning, quite quite cool blue looking, but by the time we came back in the late afternoon, we're starting to get that golden hour before sunset. So you have two golden hours in the day. You have the hour after sunrise and the hour before sunset. Beyond those are your blue hours. So before sunrise is blue hour and after sunset is blue hour. So this is a golden hour in the morning. It's just after the sun came up and it just lights up the buildings and things like that so well. If you want to get a starburst, set your aperture to a high number, as high as you can, and then try and have the light come through trees or something that's going to break it up a little bit, and it's easier. Not all cameras will do a nice starburst, but most will, even if you can't set it to too high an aperture number, say you're limited to F10 or something, if you have it come through a tree, you'll probably be fine. If you've got aperture going up to 30, then you can have less stuff around it. And it depends on the number of blades of your aperture, what kind of star you're going to get. That's kind of fun to do. And because you're shooting right into the sun, you don't have to have it on a tripod. You've got so much light coming in, even at a very tiny aperture, you'll get a good shutter speed. Okay, so capturing flowers. You don't need to have the whole flower in your image. So you can see there isn't a single flower there where you see the entire flower. But that doesn't mean it's an ugly picture. It's a nice picture of flowers. So just remember our brain fills these things in. Nice to look for the light to enhance your flowers. And after the rain, I always have a good time after the rain. So anybody who's a gardener, the ones on the left are lily of the valley, and you know how tiny those little blossoms are. So my camera was on a plastic bag sitting on the ground, shooting up to get those lily of the valley from underneath. And then the one on the right, was not from my backyard. I looked in my backyard after rain. I didn't have anything that was gathering any drops, so I went walking around the neighborhood. Well, I couldn't walk onto people's properties, but I found one. So I'm sitting on the pavement and I managed to get the shot where it's actually this flower here in the drop is this yellow one over here. Okay, so if you're looking for that type of image, you're going to have something that the flower, that the droplet can reflect. Nice short depth of field just to emphasize the droplets. Again, if you know grape hyacinths, you know how tiny they are. So this was camera right on the ground shooting up. Springtime. They're often the first things that pop up in my garden, so I'm very happy. And I didn't plant them. They blew in from somebody else's garden, so bonus. Okay, here's another fun one is trillium. So every picture I see of people taking trillium pictures, they're just shooting down because trilliums tend to lie flat to the ground. Or it looks like they're lying flat to the ground. So everybody's pictures just stand over them, take a picture, post it on Facebook. So I like to get under the trillium and do a slightly different angle. So sometimes the trillium is pointing downwards and I can get under it. And then it just brings in the whole forest when you do that. It's just an amazing effect. That trillium is probably half an inch off the ground or an inch off the ground, but as soon as you get under it, well, maybe more than an inch, whatever is the depth of my camera, let's say 3 inches, I can get under it. Just using the light. Now here's a bugaboo for me, especially in Ottawa. I see a lot of people taking tulip pictures. This is the kind of picture of tulips I don't like because there's too much dirt. And you will never see a professional tulip photo with dirt in it. You just won't. The pictures for the Tulip Festival, they never have dirt. And it goes without saying there's going to be dirt between the tulips because they're first up. There's no extra foliage or grass or anything like that. So the best thing to do, it's not getting totally nail on this one, is get down lower so there's less dirt. Still not great, but better than it was. So here's one where I got down low. So I'm shooting basically sideways and no dirt. Same with this one. Same with this one. Now, this is nice because it's a very short depth of field. I just really wanted to highlight this guy here with the pink, and everything else just softens to the background. So think about that at Tulip Festival. Try not to shoot down. If you can at all possible physically, get down on your knees and shoot sideways. Okay, I'm just going to take a sip of water here. So perfecting people photos, this is such a challenge, and I'm no expert at this for sure. So, but I can give you tips because I'm so bad at it. I have to get it. I have to learn a few tips to get myself through. And you just learn over time what works and what doesn't work. And it's like anything else, a bit of practice does go a long way. So if you're shooting strangers, be careful. Keep your distance, especially if there's kids around. Do zooming. Be really quick. Move on so that you don't make parents nervous. It's understandable if you're hovering and taking 2, 3, 4 shots. It just makes them uncomfortable. And when you're posting pictures of people you don't know, I try and post or show faces that are hard to see or no faces at all. But in most, well, in Ontario for sure, and probably every province in Canada, and in a lot of places in the world, but you have to check, it is illegal to take pictures of people in public places without getting their permission, but just be respectful and don't be like the paparazzi. And then be selective in what you post, especially if your camera has a GPS and there's children in it. That's just really not wise to show locations and that. If I'm in a foreign culture, I want something, you know, from an artisan or something, I'll buy something small. It takes so little, and they will, you know, open up their shop to you or whatever and let you help you get that best image. But they may be a little reluctant if you're not willing to, you know, buy something or give them a little bit of money. You just have to sort of play it by ear. So here was a fellow that didn't look too happy when I walked over with my camera, but I handed out, I pushed out in front of myself, I pushed out this $5 American bill, and I said, can I take your photo? And he said, you can take it all afternoon if you want. So just that one $5 bill was all it took, and I could get, and then of course you have to get them not to pose and things like that. But in this image, I put it in black and white, and I highly recommend that any picture of people you take, see if you like it in black and white. You might like it better. So in this instance, you can see why. This is just not very attractive in color. We got the belt. My eye just goes to that belt. And then it goes to the yellow hat, neither of which are attractive. So by putting it in black and white, it's more about his face, the fish, and that's what is important. So these were people, obviously, I didn't know, so I shot from behind. These two. And when you're with someone, again, you don't have to have them front and center, waving at you or smiling. So even if the person is almost out of the shot, you will find them, especially if you know the person, you're gonna find them in seconds, probably less than a second. So this was when I took a crisp, and then when I got home, I realized the colors weren't very interesting. So I thought this might look nice in black and white. I think it's much nicer, right? There's nothing we've really lost in terms of the environment or Chris. He looks just as good in black and white. And then it's nice if you just give the person something to do. So with Chris and I, we never know, as I say, when we're taking each other's pictures. But usually in the end, it's something that we're doing some sort of activity, usually related to photography. Now, this is one Chris took of me. I don't do a lot of portrait work, if that's your interest. I'm not an expert on this at all. But this was a picture Chris took of me, just using light coming in from the window on the left side there. But we put up a reflector on the right so my face wouldn't be too dark on my left side of my face, right side of this image. And it doesn't have to be a reflector you bought. I did have a reflector that someone had given me. You can just put up, you know, white Bristol board or a white sheet or something that you can easily prop there just to reflect the light bit a bit back. And then, you know, we made a nice, I was standing in front of a plain wall, and then we were able to put in a nice background. Now, kids, again, the kids' photos, especially in playgrounds, I just find the colors are so competing, it takes away from the face. And so in this image of my great niece, I put it in black and white, so it's more about her, less about the clothes and the swing or the slide and things like that. So I highly recommend you play around with black and white. Now, this was one taken many years ago where I'd prop the camera on a rock and my two sisters, and they didn't know how wide an angle I had, so they leaned in, and that's what you want, is not too much space between the heads. So this was just lucky that they did that, because I hadn't given them any instructions. And if you get asked to, you know, do photos at a wedding or a family reunion or whatever, I recommend that you work as a team with someone else. So with Chris and I my hands shake more than the bride. So I my hands shake all the time, but especially when I'm nervous. And his don't. So he has a steady hand. He gets a clean, sharp photo, but he doesn't have the same interest or ability to pose people as I'm no pro, but I do a better job of posing people and explaining to them what I want without having to touch them or anything like that. So we're a great team that way, and we did two family weddings for but that's, you know, we only do family, so don't get any ideas. And then this was the wedding of the next year, I guess, his other niece got married. So just thinking of slightly different poses. So usually, you know, bride and groom are facing the camera, but here I kind of like it. She's looking back. Is she looking back at her younger life? He's not distracted. He's just looking at her. You gotta love it. And just, I brought this up. I just had it in the car just in case we could use it, and it worked out nicely. I took this one because I was shooting backup for Chris with just a 50 lens, and I got a really nice short depth of field and a nice feel to the image. Now, if you're shooting groups like in a hotel lobby or in a living room and you've got a couch, don't stand in front of the couch, especially guys. They're not going to cuddle up. They're not going to get their heads close together. So don't even try. Just go to the corner of the couch, and then they look much more compressed together. You won't see the spaces or gaps between them, and you can get lots of people in the image. I could have put tons more in the back, and it would have been fine. The other thing that's great are staircases, because most of our height difference is in the legs. So if you put people on staircases sitting down, you can stack them, and it's easier to get all the faces showing. So I think this only took about, I don't know, 2-3 minutes to set up, because I didn't have to move people around based on height. Now, here's kind of the before picture. So I was just trying to take a snapshot to figure out what I was going to do. They thought they were posing, but they weren't doing a very good job. So and I wasn't instructing them. So, you know, they're not all looking at the camera. They're way too far apart. I got all clutter in the background here. I didn't have any choice. It wasn't my house. So not a very good picture, but this one was better. So I actually had them put their head on the next person's shoulder and then just lift it up a bit. And they all felt funny. They thought their heads were going to look like they were, you know, falling off their neck, but it doesn't look like that at all. So emphasize that, you know, bending down, just bring it up a bit so there's just a little space between, and then it looks really, really nice. And then I got rid of some of the clutter in the background. So a tip for taking big group photos where, you know, guaranteed someone's going to have their eyes closed is you before you take the picture, you say 1, 2, 3, close your eyes, and then say 1, 2, 3, open your eyes. Actually, you don't need the first 1, 2, 3. Just say close your eyes. Have everybody close their eyes, and then say 1, 2, 3, open your eyes, and nobody's going to blink because they've all just opened their eyes at the same time. Okay, so that's a good trick. Now, this was one of the weddings we were lucky enough to have a loft to shoot from, and there's probably over 100 people in that image, and so that's great. If you're shooting about 30 or 40 people and you don't have a loft, you could try a ladder. You've probably seen professional photographers use ladders. I know I was in a group of about 45 people once, and the photographer brought out a ladder just so they can get up high enough to get everybody in. So just to review, small spaces between heads, shoot from an angle or off to the side, seat people if possible on stairs or whatever. And for large groups, try and get up high, and then crop tight after, because really it's all about the people, so don't waste your time with anything else in the background unless it's very, very important. Okay, let's move on to waterside photos. I do see a lot of people struggle with these kinds of photos. You know, we often go on vacation to seaside or lakeside, and they look great, but they don't always translate into great photos. So here's one. Not kind of crooked, not very interesting sky, not very interesting water, not a very interesting beach. So not a very good photo. But I took another photo there, same place, much nicer. Why? Because, well, it helps the horizon straighter. But it's because I've got some foreground that's interesting because this seaweed is huge. And then I've got this nice little curves of the waves hitting the beach, so it adds a little bit of interest. So to me, a nicer photo than this. Now here's another one. So this is back to, are you recording the event or can you make a nice picture and record the event at the same time? So this is the Bay of Fundy. So I'm trying to show that the tide's really big, and it does, but it's a boring photo. So could I show that and still have an interesting photo? So I walked all the way back up here, around here, and I found this piece of driftwood, and I shot back from behind it and out into the beautiful bay and showed the tide from there. A much nicer photo, and you still get the idea of the big tide. So now, this is not a photo you could probably take with a cell phone, although some do have the motion setting, but again, they're all a little different. But if you were taking these types of images with a standard DSLR or a mirrorless, this is what you need. A tripod, first off, small. What you're trying to do is get a long exposure. So you want a very, very tiny aperture so that your camera has to stay open longer to get enough light. Unfortunately, if you don't take your ISO setting off automatic, it's not going to work because you're going to have a small aperture and the camera's going to say, "Oh, that's way too long exposure." It doesn't know you're on a tripod. So it's thinking, "Oh, she's not going to be able to hold that steadily enough for 2 seconds." Because, you know, as I say, it doesn't know that you've got the camera on a tripod. It's going to think, "Oh, it's going to be totally blurred. She's going to hate the image. I will bump the ISO, give her faster shutter speed." But unfortunately, when your camera bumps the ISO, it makes it very grainy. And you might have seen that if you've taken any shots evening or nighttime. It seems okay, and then you get them on your computer and you see all these little grainy dots. That's because your ISO bumped. So if you do want to take a shot like this, set it for a small aperture, high number. You'll get the longest speed as possible. On a cloudy day, you don't need more than that because you should be able to get a nice long exposure. Even half a second is fine for water. You can do longer if you want, but half second's nice. But if it's a sunny day, you're going to need a neutral density filter because to have your aperture, even at its smallest, open for, say, 2 seconds, it's just going to be a white photo. It's just going to be totally overexposed because the hole letting in the light has been open too long. So make sure you take your ISO off automatic and lower it down to about 100 or as low as you can go. And that way, you're telling your camera, "I don't need this shot to be fast. I have my tripod." Okay? Now, here's a great illustration of what I mean by compressing things around water so that you don't have too much empty spaces. So, for me, I like the sky, I like this row of boats, and I like this bottom row of boats, but I don't like all this space in the middle. Yeah, there's a bit of reflection, but it's not interesting enough for me. To me, this is too much space in the middle of nothing. So what do we do? Well, you just get down lower. So I got down lower, but I went down too low. So yeah, now I have less water in the center, but I've got these two poles from the bow of this boat. I guess he pushes other things, and it's almost touching this row of boats, so that's not attractive. So I just got up a little bit, didn't go down quite so low, and got the Goldilocks photo of having just the right amount of water in the middle. So the amount of water in the bay, almost the same as the amount of sky. I've got the nice row of boats, nice angles, really happy with that image in the end. But thank goodness I checked, because when you're just bending down, it's hard to know, hard to see if you get that compression just the way you like it. Okay, look for birds. Always interesting to be able to add in some birds. They don't have to be, I'm not looking for a fancy species or anything. That's Alan German's job. I'm just looking for any bird at all to put in my image, especially if I'm shooting waves, because waves just look boring when you get them home if you don't have something of interest in them. Adding people always helps. As I say, you don't need the permission, just be fast. Okay. Bad weather and off season. I really like this type of photography, because there's not as many images out there with bad weather shots. And so it makes some of my images a little more unique or competitive if I'm in a competition or something. And it's just nice because there's very few people as well, or fewer tourists, shall we say. So I love looking for fog on either coast. And in this case, it was fog and snow. Can't get more Canadian than that. And then early morning. So I tend to shoot early morning because that's when the fog and mist are there. It's not often you get evening fog and mist unless it's been socked in for days. But in Ottawa area, you don't get the fog in the evening. So I get out early for that. That was just down at the river. And then with the rainy days, you might not need a nutrient-density filter because you can have a longer exposure time without your image blasting out. Gives you it deepens the colors. And you don't have to worry about where the sun is, which I love, because boy, there's so many good images and you think, oh, that's just completely backlit, or this side of the image is all lit and this side's completely in the shade, or the sun's coming straight down and it's not making anything look pretty because it's noon hour sun, which is very harsh. So I love just a little bit of heavy overcast or just a slight scotch mist type thing helps a lot. And rain lasts longer than dew. So I didn't take this shot to about 9 in the morning, but it had rained and it was still overcast, so it didn't evaporate. And you get these nice, nice, heavy jewel-type drops. Snow, didn't get as many nice photos of snow this winter as I would like. This was taken a few years ago, but fresh fallen snow can make for lovely images. And people just don't take as many wintertime images as they do the summertime ones or when you're traveling. So even macro photography in the winter is fun. And I love ice because, first of all, ice is going to be different every year, but it's also different every day. So I could go back to this exact spot the next morning and the river might have washed away part of that ice or heat overnight. You just never know. It's not going to look like this ever, ever again. And then I was just playing around with abstract. So this is almost like an abstract. It's just a picture of an icy puddle. So there's always something unique in the winter. You can go back and shoot the same location year after year, even Hog's Back. It looks different every year, depending on the weather. And then you can experiment with abstract. So this was one that I took, and I kind of liked it. And then I have a kaleidoscope setting on my photo editor, and you can make adjustments. And I put this image, and somebody told me that they found in here these two eyes that it looked like raccoons lining up in the center there. Okay, I might be, I can't see my slide number, so I hope I'm not going to end too short. But we've got a few more topics to cover, and then there'll be lots of time for a question and answers. So wildlife photography, this is not my genre. This is not what I consider myself a landscape photographer, if I'm going to classify myself as anything. So, but I'm not going to ignore wildlife. It's fun. I like to go walking in the woods and getting my landscape shots, but if wildlife comes by, I'm more than happy to take a few pictures. So it's nice to have a few things in your back pocket. Now this one, I only had a 200 zoom. There was no way I was going to get a real close up of this peregrine falcon, but I didn't want to not get a picture either. So I took the photo and then I cropped it as much as I could, put a little vignette on it. Yeah, it's not going to go into the National Geographic, but it's still a nice photo to show amongst friends. This one was taken through my sister's window. So a bit of a haze there, but after doing a little bit of a photo adjusting and a slight vignette on that, I could pop the blue jay out a bit. Now here's when, now if I'm at a trail where I'm with a birder or I know there's going to be birds that are going to tempt me, as soon as I get out of the car, I set my shutter speed for what's going to work for birds. And what works for birds is extremely fast. So you want a day that's bright enough that you can set a shutter speed to say 1/1500th of a second or even 1/2000th of a second, because if it's a nuthatch like this, you need exactly that fast or you're going to get nothing. And birds tend to fly and move. That's what they do. They don't stand still for long because they're always checking and making sure there's no prey around. So that's the first thing I do when I get out of the car is get the fastest speed I can, and then I look for the bird that moves the least, let's put it that way, and see if I can get a shot. So here's where I did have a wide aperture, low number. I got the fastest shutter speed possible that day, and I think the nuthatch just stopped for 1 nanosecond, and I was able to catch him. Now here you can see bright sunny day, wide open aperture, and I still could only get, and I got 1/1600th of a second, which is pretty darn fast, but you can still see the blur in the wings. So there's nothing wrong with that, but you can see how fast you'd have to be to actually freeze frame those, that motion of the wings. Think about it like a hummingbird or something like that. And if it's a dull day, even though the ISO can work against you when you're trying to do a long exposure, if you need more speed, just bump your ISO higher, accept the graininess, because on a photo like this, the grain is going to appear in the sky, and the new editing programs are really, really good for reducing noise, which is what it's called. The graininess is called noise. So the noise reduction programs are great, so I would sacrifice it. I would go for the 1600, even if I had to bump the ISO, and I'd worry about the noise later and make it as best as I could. With bird photography, you're looking for eyes. You always want to be able to see the eye. This is not a good example here. I've got the two eyes, but most bird photographers don't like it when you're shooting from below, so they would probably poo-poo that. This one is not too bad, but it would be better if I had both eyes. And then if you like wildlife, I highly recommend places like Park Omega. They're lovely. They're very natural. Yeah, the animals are there. And then, you know, in the acres and acres, there is a fence somewhere and they're not going to leave. But it's still in a natural type environment. And it's lots of fun. So if you like nature, I was hoping to go in the winter this year, but the weather just, you know, wasn't really conducive enough to want to spend a lot of time. I wanted the nice snowy grounds with the animals. And again, nature's messy and busy, and that's just the way nature is. So if you want to soften that down, open your apertures, put it to aperture priority. Give it a small number so it's nice and wide, and it will give you that soft background. The tricky thing, of course, is you want to make sure most of the squirrel is in sharp focus. So if it's too wide an aperture, you might lose the focus here, but in this instance, I'm losing a little bit at the very tail end, but that's okay. So the best situation is when you can isolate something, and by that I mean there isn't a branch that's right behind them. There isn't a branch like this right behind them. The branches behind them are quite far back, and that gives you a fighting chance. If you're trying to get a nice soft background and things are too close to the image you're shooting, very difficult to get it soft enough without losing the focus on your on your of your subject matter. So try and isolate things. And you can do that if it's a pussy willow or a rose or something. You can just sort of angle around and get that one position where there's nothing in the background for quite a long ways, and then you'll get that nice soft bouquet in the background. Okay, I don't have any pets, but here's what I hear are tips for pets, and I have taken pictures of some family pets. So focus on the eye or the facial expression. This goes for all wildlife. If you're going to focus on anything, point your focal point to the eyeballs if you possibly can. And then if it's a pet, get rid of any clutter that's around the pet and follow that natural light. So if it's coming in from a window, work with that. If you're outside with them, get down low if you're shooting them in their environment, so that, you know, you might get a shot of them sort of walking towards you. And you don't want them sort of looking like less than looking up at you. You want to get down at their level if you can. And then add some context if you're trying to tell a story. I'll show you an example of that. Move slowly. Because if you move to, say they're doing something really cute and fascinating, if you move quickly, then they might come running to you figuring you have a treat or something. So try and move slowly. And obviously you want them to be used to you, not a stranger. And then crop tightly after. So here's one that Chris took of my sister's dog waiting for daddy to come home. And so it's just kind of cute and nice, sort of going away from the standard rule of thirds and just putting away in that bottom corner. So I like the composition. The same dog, I took this shot, but, you know, get rid of the clutter. Crop in as tight as you can once you get the shot. I could have even gone even tighter if I'd had a slightly better image quality. Okay, sunrise and sunset. So, as I mentioned before, you've got your blue hour before sunrise. That's when this was taken, and you do get some lovely tones of blue, but also oranges and reds and anything else that the sky is offering. And then you have the golden hour, and then at nighttime you have the golden hour before the sun sets, and then you have the blue hour after the sun sets. And there's various apps you can get. I'm going to try and download one that I might do a share on at the Q&A. There's one that helps you predict whether or not there's going to be clouds, whether they're going to be low-level clouds, mid-level clouds, or whether it's going to be very, very sunny. And I think I've already shared the one, Photophemeris, which I use all the time to determine where the sun's going to come up, exactly when it's going to come up, how it's going to traverse through the sky during the day, where it's going to set, the angle, etc. So we will literally book our hotels based on what I've seen in Photophemeris, because I might just want to go out the front door and shoot the dawn without having to get in the car. So we will book our accommodations based on that. So one of these things where the rule doesn't apply in terms of putting things in the middle, it's okay to put the sun in the middle. Don't know why, just an accepted rule. But instead of this, I see a lot of pictures like this, kind of boring in my opinion. So try and build something in. And I always like it when there's clouds in front of the sun, so it's not just a white space in the middle of my photo, or off, even if it's off to the side. And you don't have to have the sun in the middle for sure. So in this instance, I had a few clouds going across it, and that made it nice. So these were just taken at Petrie Island. And the other advantage of the morning, if it's a lake or something, is you get reflections. You don't get that at night typically. You know, there's too many boats going out or too much wind has picked up. But if you're first thing in the morning, you get that lovely soft water, the reflections, and that can be really nice. And don't forget portrait mode. I notice this often with people's photos of sunrise and sunset. They typically are in landscape mode, but don't forget portrait mode can be really nice too. That's more typical, sort of, that's actually more panoramic format for that image for landscape. And again, so shot very early in the morning. So not only am I getting the sun coming up with that lovely sky, but I'm getting this row, this line of mist, which is gone after about 15 minutes after sunrise. Again, another early in the morning shot. Sun had just come over. Well, guess how long that frost would last? Probably 3 minutes. I had to shoot very fast because it melts so quickly and it's certainly not there in the evening. So I was able to get this shot where it almost looked like little lanterns. Okay, so I am ending a little earlier than I thought, so apologies for that, but let's just do a summary. I got a few more slides here. So the composition, just a reminder of using the rule of thirds and then following the light. Either early in the morning or late in the evening is your best chance for light. Midday light you can use, but it's a lot trickier. So if I'm on a tour or something, middle of the day, if they're stopping and say, okay, everybody's got an hour and a half to have lunch or go shoot some photos. I don't shoot photos. I go have the lunch, but it's just not my favorite time to shoot photos. If you're putting people, shooting groups of people, put them close together, have them overlap arms, shoulders, have and oftentimes have people turn their bodies. Having your body, even if you're very slim, having your body directly facing the camera is not flattering to most people. And on an angle, no matter what your size is much more flattering. And then try out black and white when you get back home. You may prefer it. And certainly don't ignore bad weather if you can. I really enjoy that. And it can be challenging, but it's very rewarding. And go for a sunrise instead of a sunset. So you can get, I've given Chris a PDF of these slides, and he's given me a link there where you can get it at the on the OPCUG site, and I think he's already posted that. I have a couple of YouTube videos. This is more they're more on travel photography. They're pretty old, but there's also some editing videos on that YouTube site. Using Photoscape X, which I've demoed to you guys before. And then this is a fantastic site for anybody who's trying to get off of auto. It's a live site where you actually can adjust. You've got an image of an airplane with a propeller, and you can slide the aperture, you can slide the shutter speed, and you can see right away. You can take a picture and you can see what happens when I set it to that speed. Oh, it freezes the propeller, or oh, it makes the propeller blurry because I gave it a half second. So it gives you that direct feedback as to what that image would look like with different apertures. So if you're just getting off auto, it's a really, really handy one to use. And maybe I can give a demo of that as well. I think Chris already has given a demo of that. So I think that's probably my last slide. So I will stop sharing and I'm happy to take questions because we do have quite a bit of time. It was just hard to judge how to do a 90-minute presentation when I didn't have much warning.
That was excellent, Linda. Thank you so much. There's a lot of good comments in here,
Okay.
in here, and they're still flowing in here as I read them here. I know Bill was excited to try some of these things, and he likes your tips. And these are all things we can all try. I do some drone stuff and my cell phone, but it's fun to apply these things. And I think about these things when I do photographs. So I'm happy to learn more and apply these things.
Okay, so yeah, there's some good tips from Tom Trottier, especially when you're trying to do that calculation of if my focal length is equal to this and my aperture is equal, my depth of field is this, then always good to know because sometimes when you're zoomed, you might only have 2 inches in front and 2 inches behind, and you wonder why, your main subject isn't as sharp as you would like. So that's good. And if those ratio after the photos of two. Okay, some more technical things. I'm not as technical, and unfortunately, Chris often will supplement my technical comments, but he had to go make another presentation, so he's no longer on the Zoom.
I know Tom was asking, do you use for the close-ups, do you use a macro lens or extension tubes or what?
Yeah, I do. So I'm actually the next photo column in the newsletter. I'm going to write about different lenses and what are some of the advantages and disadvantages of different lenses. I have a macro lens that I use regularly. It's usually always in my camera bag, and I do change lenses. Some people will buy an extra lens and then they always think, oh, it's not worth changing my lens. But I do. I will change my lens back and forth multiple times in an hour when I'm shooting, because if I see something that it suits the macro. So I do use macro, not so much for, I use it for nature shots like plants or lichen or something like that. It's tricky because the lens I have, you have to have a very long depth of field to even get like an inch. I'd have to be at sort of f 18, like 20, like really high, and that means it's a long shutter speed. So oftentimes for my macro, if I'm serious about the macro and I want a really good shot, I recommend a tripod because the macro to get any good depth, the macro depth of field may only be like a fraction of an inch, and that's just not even enough for a piece of ice, right? So you to get the longer depth of field with a macro, I do recommend a tripod, but I don't follow my advice usually. I'm usually just, oh, I can do this, and I will rest it on something and use it that way. But I don't think I could live without my macro, but it's not for everyone. And as I say, if you have a standard sort of 28 or to 200 zoom or even longer, usually you can't get too close to the thing you're shooting, but you can stand back and zoom, and you can also get a short depth field, get your bokeh in the background, and then crop it when you get home, because if you've got a good camera, you've probably got enough megapixels that you can crop in and get your macro when you get home. But I do highly recommend that technique of zooming with if you have a zoom, stand back and zoom, and you'll get a nicer background, I think.
So when you do the low shots, do you have to change the lens for that?
Yes.
Like your flowers and all that, or?
Well, not always. It just
No.
depends.
Okay.
It depends what I want. But if I was when I did that Trillium, I didn't have a macro, so that was just. But yeah, it just depends. If your lens won't allow you to get that close, but I was shooting with something that had a super macro lens built in. But with my DSLR, I'd have to switch that to the macro, put it on the ground, shoot up. I do a lot of that. I do a lot of shooting up. It's I find it fun, and it gives a different perspective, and it makes people realize what my life is like at 5'1", right?
I know I used your tips. I had some friends at the Richcraft Recreation Complex. They have some like copper boxes on the sidewalk. They're built into the sidewalk. I wanted a picture of my friends there. I got down on the sidewalk, laid down, it's pretty clean there, and got a shot behind with the fox behind them. And that was your tip. But that made an awesome picture because the fox was in the foreground. And as you mentioned that also, it gave a depth to the shot.
If Alan's still on, can he unmute everyone? Because at this point, people should be able to unmute themselves. Maybe
I don't know how to do that, yes.
he's probably already given people that ability. I just
I
want to
know
make
when Stuart asked about, he had a passion for the black and white stuff. He says the color is quite complex. He admires your passion for the black and white photographs.
It is a lot of fun when you do black and white, and it's so much simpler when you're doing photo editing for sure. Your histograms don't have all these different color channels on them. It's just you've got your gray tones, you got your black points. It's a joy. So if it does work, but what I have found, if anybody does become involved in like a photo club or something like that, I have found that black and white images get low marks, especially in the winter, because people are just dying to see color. They crave color. So the images that tend to do really well in the wintertime competitions are very colorful, and the black and white ones tend to not do as well. But I do love them. I think they can, there's so many distractions that color can cause when you didn't really want somebody's eye to go there. and there's just nothing you can do about it. You can desaturate it a bit, but there's just sometimes I get more and more in the habit of even looking at landscape, even trees. I was attending a lecture on the weekend in our photo club, and this gentleman was, his whole expertise was, the whole lecture was on trees. And he shot a lot of black and white in November. And I thought, what a great idea, because you don't have the autumn leaves. You don't, but you didn't have the foliage getting in the way. So you have way nicer geometry of these, of leafless trees, but in black and white. So it just didn't look dull or brown or ugly November. So that was a good tip. So even nature can look interesting and fun in black and white. So what else do we have here? Cameras, but you said.
So I think I found a setting to unmute everybody, so you should be able to mute the microphone now, people.
That's great. And yes, there are controls. If you have like a high dynamic range situation, you can set up in your camera that it will take, say, underexposed, middle exposed, overexposed, and then given the right software, you can combine those when you get home so that you don't have to try and lighten a dark area or a shadowy area. You'll have one fairly dark photo, one middle kind of photo, and one light one, and you just merge them together and you get a really nice image. Polaroid filters. Yeah, Polaroid filters are good. Polaroid is very helpful for getting some blues. If you have a camera that doesn't seem to give you blue skies, even on a nice day, Polaroid filters can help. Polaroid filters tend to work when the sun is more at an angle. So I don't use it when I'm shooting directly in the sun. I don't use them trying to get a starburst. I might use neutral density filters and things like that to get effects. But a Polaroid filter, I tend to use near water if the sun is coming at a bit of an angle. But I do find it's great for getting blue skies. You just have to play around. It depends on your lens. And you're right, Tom. Yes, it can intensify rainbows. And you always have to rotate. Yeah, and the Polaroid filter doesn't screw on tight. It spins. So you have to turn it to get what you want. And it might take a couple of shots to figure out what is the best angle to put that polarizing filter on for that time of day and the angle of the sun. I play around. I don't have enough of the numbers in my head. I usually just play around. So I'm not going to be taking pictures of the solar eclipse. I'm not an expert on this, but we do have experts here. It seems tonight Timothy might want to comment on how to take how to safely take images of the solar eclipse. Did you intend to do that, Tim?
Yeah, what I did for the 2017, I took a spare visor or the sun shield and put it on the camera to protect the sensor, because I zoom in before the sun is even eclipsed. And also it makes it protects the camera.
Sure, because this is a worry that the sun will do damage to your sensor if you've got a wide open aperture. I don't know if these concerns are valid, but for sure, if you want to be safe, protect your camera as much as your eyeball, I guess, is the bottom line.
Yeah, you use it for any camera that you're trying to zoom up, even on the cell phone.
Well, there's no point in or little point in taking pictures of the sun until you're in totality. And when you're in totality, you don't need a filter. But you got to be careful that when you're coming out, you don't get a big blast either to your camera or to your eyes for a DSLR, because it'll go right through and it can burn your eyes.
Right. Exactly. So be careful, err on the side of caution, even if you miss the shot, because you don't want to. It's one thing to risk your camera, it's another thing to risk your eyes. So,
yeah, and there's lots of different websites that calculate the time of location where you are when the sun is in its totality.
Yeah.
So keep that in mind when you don't have your shield on. The eye shield's on.
Yeah.
When you're in totality, you can look at the sun then,
yeah.
No problem.
Okay.
But just keep in mind,
by the way, there's
the limit, the time limit.
There's a $2 app. I'll put it in the forum that runs on Android that counts down to totality and then counts back out from totality.
Okay.
That'll give you a warning.
That's a good idea.
And, And it does that based on your GPS location, so it's exact.
Oh, excellent. Good idea. Okay, now there's a comment here, ask question about whether or not the sensor would be damaged shooting the sun through foliage, etc. No, I would not worry about that. And if you're shooting directly at the sun, as I say, typically I've got it down to a very small aperture, so I've never had that concern because the hole is very tiny. But even if it was a wide aperture, it'll probably just blast out your image, but I would think you can Google this, but from what I've heard from others, that should not be an issue with the sun coming through foliage or even a normal sunrise or something like that. I just don't know enough about the eclipse if it's any different. But a normal sun situation, no. You can shoot directly at it. You might not get a good image. But typically if I'm shooting directly at the sun, I have a very tiny aperture. All right, more solar. Our animation teachers always encourage us to use the low angle for more dynamic scenes. Yes, absolutely. Totally agree. Okay, and then Gail mentioned that there was somebody who presented on solar eclipses a few months ago, so perhaps people can look that up. Okay.
And I liked your comment about leading the viewer through the image, using the person in the picture to lead the...
It's a good trick to know. It's a good trick to have because people will automatically, even if, say, there was that pagoda in the background, your instinct is, honey, stand in front of this photo. I'll take your picture and the pagoda will be in the background.
Yep.
And we'll look at that photo. We're going to go to the person's face. And probably people aren't even going to notice there was something way in the background because they're looking at the person. But if you don't let them look at the person's face, then the first thing they think of is, what's he looking at? And so it can be very helpful in those faraway situations.
Definitely. It's fun to apply these things. I find myself, with your tips, I often set up a photograph, often my granddaughter and stuff, but I take a minute and if it's set up photograph, I'll pause or I'll move the image and get your thirds thing set up. It doesn't take long. I don't edit it after, but
it
makes a big difference.
I did a travel photography presentation to a seniors group, and I was coming back about 2 months later to do some photo editing. And two of the ladies were traveling together, and I knew they were heading off for a trip right after my lecture. And when they came back, they said every time they got off the bus, they said, what would Linda do? So they just
went
through their heads. Where's my foreground? Where's the light? How much time do I have before I get back on the bus? And for that kind of situation, I highly recommend that you check your image. I go back on the bus a couple minutes early so I can see my images in the nice quality light. If you don't have a mirrorless and you can't see them in your viewfinder easily, it's hard to see it on the back screen and get that detail. So I go back in the bus and then I'm like, I don't like this one. It's got a little bit of blur. I go back on the bus and reshoot it. So give yourself time to do that. You won't regret it.
And as Bill says, if you're standing, kneel down and look at it again at the same thing. It's so many different shots are down there.
Look at different angles. I've seen people's travel photos, and I can tell you exactly how tall they are because every single image is the same. They haven't sat down. They haven't got high. They haven't got low. They haven't kneeled. It's just that person is 5'9", and he's 5'9" in every single shot. So nice variety. For sure, and I stress that in my travel presentation, is you're trying to tell an interesting story and you want to mix things up and make it interesting.
So it's all things you can put into practice right away with. I use a lot of cell phone stuff and my drone too, but...
you've got the challenge of drone photography, and
cell phones are great.
For sure. As I say, they are becoming more and more... cell phones have more and more ability to do adjustments, but that doesn't mean people are going to do the adjustments. The cameras had ability to do adjustments for years, and lots of people will leave it on auto. So just because the cell phone has the ability doesn't mean people are going to use it, but at least the capacities are coming on with cell phones. So I'm looking forward to the day I can exactly set the aperture of my cell phone and not just let it kind of guess for me. But for sure, I'd be lost without it for low light indoor situations. I can't remember the last time I took an indoor shot where I wasn't setting up like a studio still life or something like that. Just a casual shot. I cannot remember the last time I used it.
I have a question for you about my cell phone. I use it a lot. If I take a cell phone picture under low light conditions, which deliberately,
yeah,
it takes about 7 seconds for the phone. You can see it. It's thinking, thinking.
Yeah. No, it's not thinking. What it's doing is, in my case anyway, what it does is if you tell it's a low light situation, it's taking, it knows you can't hold that cell phone steadily in low light. So it's taking about 6 or 7 shots, and then it has to merge them together. That's what takes the time, because it knows you probably didn't hold that very steadily. So it's taking do, and then it puts them together and gives the sharpest photo it can back to you.
I see. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Now, it depends on the cell phone how many pictures it's going to take, but most, that's, I believe, that's the kind of programming it does.
I see.
You can also use night mode in Android to take photos any time of the day or night. Sure. And it does the same thing. It takes the 6-7 photos. And instead of kind of in a low light situation, it mostly adds them together and coordinates the picture so that everything is reinforcing. And the same thing happens in regular light, and it puts the photos together, and you will get a generally speaking, a sharper image with more detail if you use the night mode all the time.
Yeah.
But it does take more time.
Yeah, it takes more time, but that's a good tip. I don't typically use it in daylight situations, but you're right. It is going to end up with a better image because you told it to go take multiple images and give me the best combination. So, yeah, good idea.
Fantastic.
Okay, so I don't know if anybody has any closing words for the meeting, or if I guess there's a standard Q&A next week.
No, we have a Q&A next week, I believe. I didn't have any slides. Ibby Allen has some slides to close these things off, but I enjoyed the meeting lots, and I'm going to apply as many of these as I can.
Okay, well, that's great. I'm glad people enjoyed it, and never hesitate to email me directly or through Alan or Chris. I'm happy to answer any questions.
And Kareem mentioned that likes the idea of using black and white pictures for her own children. Her own children.
Well, and I think we get the idea, too. We're reminded by when we look at our own photos from, you know, the 50s and 60s, at least mine were, that they were all black and white, and some of them were so fantastic, and you think, why don't mine look like that? Okay, so, yeah, the black and white is good because your eye goes to the face. It doesn't go to that bright pink shirt or whatever. So.
And there's one question, Linda, about your photography club.
Okay,
Ed was asking where they meet.
Yeah, so I was given a bit of time to plug the Orleans Photo Club at a recent Q&A, but I'm happy to plug it again. So the Orleans Photo Club, we meet part of the year online on Zoom in the winter months. And the reason for that isn't just weather. We are all a little bit older. Part of it is weather. But the other reason is we can have remote speakers that way. So last month, our March meeting was our last Zoom meeting for the season, and we had a speaker from Massachusetts that morning. Now, April, we'll be back in person. We meet at Queenswood Heights, close to the Orleans Shopping Plaza, and we're in a little community center there. We're about 50 people, so it's a very cozy club. You get to know everyone, mostly retired, but we're bringing on some youngins, and they're dead keen, and they're doing a great job, and they're even on the exec, so we're getting lots of good input from them, and their knowledge of social media, of course, goes beyond everybody else's. So thanks very much, Bob. Yes, that's the link to the CPOPSI. It's called CPOPSI because it's supposed to be Club Photographe Orleans Photo Club, so it's not a fully bilingual club. We certainly would love to have each lecture fully bilingual, but it's not. But by all means, if you if French is your first language, you'll have lots of fellow photographers. We do outings. They're not required. You don't have to. They're optional. We do challenges every month. That's my responsibility to set up the challenges and competitions. We do some interclub competitions as well. Again, they're not mandatory. You participate if you like, and then you get feedback on your images. And people will score your images. But, you know, the comments I found very useful. And I can honestly say I'm a way better photographer now than I was 4 years ago when I joined the club, because your friends aren't hard enough on you. That's why I find they're just too nice. So, you know, but the club is tough on me. They're really tough. And now I'm at the upper level. And so I have to keep my game strong. Okay, well, I think we're coming. Oh, there we go. We've got the
next
thing. So anybody wants to put in their comments or suggestions, questions, everything, the usual suggestions box at opcug.ca. And I guess we can close it down there, unless anybody has any other announcements or notices they need shared.
Well, I enjoyed that a lot. Thank you so much, Linda.
Okay. Thank you very much, everyone.
It was very successful.
Okay. No. Bye.
Really nice. Thanks.
Thanks, Dee.
Thank you, everybody.